on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, a look at oxygen levels in Macquarie Harbour.
So we're seeing oxygen levels now that at the best they've been for well over a decade. So we're seeing really good conditions in the system that are naturally driven. We also know that salmon biomass has come down, so that will have played a role. And the oxygenation trial is proving really positive.
And problems with the PALM scheme.
We saw several pay slips that people showed us where they'd receive like zero take-home pay, like zero net pay. They're largely being exposed to situations that are equivalent to modern slavery. So they have no legal status in Australia. That means they have no support for Medicare, for work cover.
We'll talk about PALM workers disengaging with the scheme. A special report today as the season gets underway in many areas. Researchers on oxygen levels in the trials at Macquarie Harbour using a machine to create bubbles of oxygen. The trial proving a success. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Monday. Hope your weekend was successful. I know there were some good falls of rain in parts of the state over the weekend. We had 0.5 of a mil in the rain gauge here at the Hobart studios of ABC. We'll chat with the Bureau in around about 10 minutes from now, see what's in store this week, and get some totals from around the state. Also coming up today, how the Marinus Link cable will be laid on the seafloor, and indeed how it will be connected from Tasmania to Victoria. And we talk mangoes from the Northern Territory. The industry there is becoming a huge supplier to the rest of the country, including Tasmania, and we'll detail some of that history about mangoes. We'll take your thoughts too via the text line 0438 922 936, that number 0438 922 936. First up, oyster growers who sheltered customers and neighbours on their barge during the Dolphin Sands fires at the height of the flames on Friday are grateful their house and farm were spared in the blaze. Cassie Melrose from Melshell Oysters believes their sprinkler system helped to save the property. She recounted the events to Larissa Smith.
It just was just so windy. It was just impossible for them to control it. It was just hot and windy, yeah. We didn't feel like we were in danger, but we were all getting pretty restless, and we suggested that we go down to the oyster farm and get the barge. And even if we just are prepared and we're just there at the oyster shack, but then we were very nervous. We started to see a lot more flames. And so then we got on the barge and I said, I don't know if we need to do this, but I think we would all feel better floating on the water. So we launched the boat. We also collected my neighbour, Karen. Her husband stayed on shore at that point. And then our other neighbour came down with his tinny, and they had themselves launched as well. So there was the two boats at that point in the river. So we're using the Yellow Sandbanks jetty there.
You had, at that point, while you were on the barge watching from the river, did you know how safe your house would be at that point, or if it could be saved?
That was not the scary one. So it kind of calmed down. We had a beautiful sunset cruise and thought, that's okay, it's blowing away. It's more on the beach side. We'll go back to shore, we're okay. So we went back to shore, we went back to the house, and there was just a change in light, I think it was, that triggered me, that it had changed, that the wind had changed, the light had changed. And I looked out the window and my son came up to me, he said, something's happening. And Ian got a call at that time, and I don't want to be held account for anything that I say, but I think it was a fiery saying, there's nothing we can do. It's created its own kind of weather now. You got to get out. We can't fight this. And so we evacuated to the boat again. Most of us drove our cars to the farm. It's only 400 metres. Ian got the sprinklers going again, so we did the sprinklers the first time as well, and then he restarted the sprinklers on our house. We just got four, one on each corner. We launched again. It was terrifying. We were just watching it, thinking that it's all gone. You could see flames in front of our house, behind our house, around our sand shack structure. We're building visitor accommodation at the moment. that had just been framed. We just had all the electrics done. The roof had just been put on. My son's an angel. He just kept pulling my head and saying, "We're not looking at that," and telling me just silly stories. And said, "It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine." So at that point, we had the two boats back in the water again. So we had four on the small teeny, and I think it was 11 on our boat. And I just said, "Anne, look, this isn't good for our mental health to stand here and float here and watch our worlds just blow up. Let's go." And I think everyone at that point realised the smoke was just going to get bad too. So we went to Swanwick and disembarked Anne and Don and rang whoever we could ring, but nobody was answering. It was 1:30 in the morning, to pick them up and get them into Coles Bay. Eventually Anne got hold of a lovely man who picked them up. So the West Australians and Anne and Don went to Coles Bay, and then we went back up the stream. Ian was just conscious that if it turned, he needed to be close to that jetty and get anyone else that he needed to get, fireys or anyone.
By the morning, you were wondering what was happening to your business and to the house.
Yeah, we went back to our house. We've been there ever since. We've had no power, but we've got a generator. The only thing we're lacking is hot water. So we're very gracious that one of the ladies that was evacuated, the second evacuation, we picked up another lady. That's right. The police escorted her down onto the barge. And she graciously has given us her keys to her shack when she was able to go back to her home. So we've got a lovely place to just come and have breakfast now and showers.
Do you consider yourself one of the lucky ones then, Cassie?
Oh, it's a miracle, Larissa, that we didn't lose anything. We've lost our fifth-wheeler caravan that was our overflow accommodation for workers. And Anne and Don lost their fifth-wheeler caravan. That was ridiculous. I know it is, but they still work on the farm at their age and they spend the week in that van and then go home on the weekends to Coles Bay. So that's gone, and the other caravan, but that's nothing. We are so lucky.
The smoke and the ash and all of that, will that affect any of the oysters growing in the water?
I think it's too far upstream. So most of our stock is closer to River and Rocks and the River Mouth and then Great Oyster Bay. Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think we'll have smoked oysters.
A new market potentially.
I had quite a lot of stock that Helena had shucked on Thursday that needed a home. So we rang a couple of restaurants in Swansea and organised them to go out on Saturday, and Ian got a police escort front and back to do the oyster delivery through and met the chefs on the other side of the roadblock and did the handover.
Dolphin Sands seems to have, in the last few years, a lot of fires. It's a very bushfire-prone region. Why do you think that's been the case for someone who's lived there for a long time?
There's regulations on clearing that people potentially just are worried that if I do too much, I'll get in trouble. So there's fuel there. There's just too much fuel. And it's just sand. So any moisture we ever get just dissipates. It just is soaked up through the sand and we don't have any retained moisture in any of our vegetation. So once it starts, it's just away.
What do you think are the lessons from this fire then, with regard to potential changes to policies around clearing?
I don't want to comment yet. It's too early, but we definitely needed our sprinkler system. So I'd suggest anyone can get what they can get up and running for this season in any place, in any state.
And you think that your sprinkler system helped to save your house and your business?
We didn't have any at the farm itself, at the farm sheds, but we always knew where a fire would come to our property, and that's the corner that we put the sprinklers on. And you can see it obviously melted the hose that we had for the tank for that at some point. So it didn't keep sprinkling, but it dampened enough that there is a grass arc of green where that sprinkler range went. So it's had to have helped. There was a massive vigilia tree just behind where the sprinkler was that has no damage at all.
Are you still able to process your oysters that need processing?
Yes, Ian's working today. He went out on Saturday and returned stock that he had too. And, yeah, the show keeps going for him. And I think that's his therapy. So, yeah, he picked up oysters Saturday to do a little bit today. We'll definitely be supplying wholesalers and restaurants this week, but we'll be keeping that farm gate close to the public maybe for a couple of weeks. I'm not ready.
Yeah, Cassie Melrose from Melshell Oysters at Dolphin Sands talking there to Larissa Smith about the fire threat over the weekend. And she says she'd like to thank the TAS Fire Service and TAS Networks for their help too with that fire at Dolphin Sands. All right, time to check the latest on the weather. Matthew Thomas joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Matthew.
G'day, Tony.
It was a little bit of rain about over the weekend. Any help there with the fires?
Look, most of the rain did fall about the west of the state, so and the parts of the north. So certainly the rainfall on Saturday into Sunday, so the rainfall recorded to 9 a.m. on Sunday, the highest total was actually at Lake Mackenzie with 56 millimetres, but about the west we saw 44 millimetres at Lake Burbury. And 20 millimetres at Strawn. But when you start looking at the totals about the east coast, it was a little bit. So Tryabunna picked up 9 millimetres and Swansea 8 millimetres in those showers that pushed through. The rainfall to 9 a.m. this morning, however, has largely been about the north and the west of the state. We did see some showers just yesterday pushed through the south of the state, but we saw nothing about the east coast. And the highest total to 9 a.m. this morning was 51 millimetres about Lake Margaret, generally 20 to 30 millimetres about the west of the state, and through the north of the state, a little bit more modest, with the totals generally in the order of 1 to 5 millimetres there. Now, in terms of the rainfall since 9 a.m., we've seen the showers just continue about the west and the north, with the higher totals about the west of the state, generally around 5 to 15 millimetres there. Now, what we've got is a cold front approaching. We'll see that cold front move across the state in the afternoon and evening. It has been producing some gusty winds about parts of Tasmania, particularly about the south and the east. We've seen the highest wind gusts about the obvious places, Mount Psyker Island, Mount Wellington. We did see 76 kilometres an hour at Hobart and 74 kilometres an hour at Strawn. This morning we have been in a little bit of a lull. We're beginning to see the winds pick back up, and the highest gusts that we have seen since 9 a.m. have also been about the more elevated locations, but we have seen totals sort of 60 to 70 kilometres an hour about much of the state, and we will see gusty conditions as the front does cross. So we do have a severe weather warning out for damaging winds about parts of the east. And we're expecting to see those winds be at their strongest as the front does cross late afternoon into early evening. Otherwise, we're expecting generally around 20 to 40 millimetres about the west of the state, around 2 to 10 millimetres through the north, and mostly less than 2 millimetres elsewhere about the east and the southeast of Tasmania. Now, into tomorrow, a westerly stream, significantly drier in air mass, although we will see some showers push into the west of Tasmania. We're looking there at around sort of 2 to 10 millimetres about the west. But with the drier air pushing across and still remaining fairly gusty, we do have high fire dangers about the Upper Derwent Valley, the southeast, Midlands and east coast districts. We will see some clearing showers about the northeast in the morning, early morning, so before dawn, and we'll see, you know, sort of 1 to 5 millimetres about the far northeast with those showers clearing. otherwise it'll just be showers into the west. And then a ridge of high pressure moves over Tasmania. Unfortunately, the winds do begin to ease through Wednesday and Thursday and carry on into to Friday when they shift more northerly as the high moves out to the east. But we're looking at largely dry days over much of Tasmania for those with more settled weather and lighter winds.
Yeah, and temperatures at the moment, Matthew?
So looking at the temperatures across the state, the warmest temperatures are about the southeast and east of the state. We have made it up to 23 degrees at Hobart and Campania and Hobart Airport, and as well as Dunelli. Bushy Park also has made 23 degrees, and about the east coast, Friendly Beaches has been up to 20 degrees, which is where it currently is, Maria Island at 19 degrees.
Okay, and by the weekend, will those temperatures be around about those averages?
So looking at the weekend, we're going to see that the temperatures begin to warm on Friday as the winds shift more northerly with that high pressure system moving out to the east. So we are going to see above average temperatures. Into Saturday, there will be a trough just moving across the state, and we'll see, you know, some lightish showers about parts of the north and the west, but the chance of thunderstorms actually developing about eastern and southeastern districts during the afternoon. A significant front to cross on Sunday, and we're once again looking at a wet day, particularly about the west of the state, with that front crossing on Sunday.
Now, the warnings, you mentioned that severe weather warning in parts of the east.
Yes, so that's probably the most significant warning that we do have, the severe weather warning for damaging winds about the Midlands and the East Coast District. But we also have a gale warning for southwestern coastal waters from southeast Cape to low Rocky Point, a strong wind warning for all remaining coastal waters as well as the southeast inshore waters and the southwest lakes. Looking at the coastal waters for today, we've got the northwesterly winds of 20 to 30 knots, reaching 35 knots about the southwest, with those winds shifting west to northwesterly at 20 to 30 knots during the day or during the afternoon and evening as that front does cross. Into tomorrow, westerly winds of 20 to 30 knots, but reaching 30 to 35 knots in the south. But the winds lighter about the east coast with inshore afternoon sea breezes and tending west to southwesterly at 15 to 25 knots about the northwest coastal waters. In terms of the swells around the west and the south, we've got a westerly of 3 to 4 metres, which will build tomorrow to be 4 to 5 metres during the afternoon and evening. About the north, a west to northwesterly of 0.5 to 1.5 metres, and about the east, there's a southerly below 1 metre, but tending southwesterly 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south. The wave rider buoy at Cape Sorel currently shows a significant wave of 5.3 metres, a maximum wave of 7.9 metres, and a 10-second period. The wave rider buoy at Maria Island shows a significant wave of 1.7 metres, a maximum wave of 2.8 metres, and the period is only around 8 seconds.
Fantastic. Thanks, Matthew.
No worries. Bye.
Good on you, Matthew Thomas from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the Country Hour.
International Day of People with Disability recognises the contributions and achievements of over 5.5 million Australians with disability. Check out some of the ABC's great content at abc.net.au/idpwd.
On air, online, on digital and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
To the west now, west coast, and oxygenation levels in Macquarie Harbour are the best they've been for a decade, according to scientists. An oxygenation trial, partly funded by the federal government, is still underway on the remote waterway, and there are moves to ramp it up to become a more permanent tool. Professor Jeff Ross, senior researcher at the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies, spoke to Fiona Breen about a new baseline study on the Doncaster Channel and why it's so important, and also spoke about Macquarie Harbour.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the big lessons that was learned at Macquarie Harbour, is that we don't understand enough about that system before the industry expanded. And now we're, you know, I guess we're having to deal with those consequences and try and make up and do a lot of science as we speak.
Well, as we'll talk more about what's going to happen here in the Doncaster Channel, but I did want to ask you about Macquarie Harbour and how the oxygenation and all that project's going.
Yeah, look, I think things have been quite good lately. I think we've had probably 3 out of the last 4 years we've had really good, quite dry summers. So we're seeing oxygen levels now that are the best they've been for well over a decade. So we're seeing really good conditions in the system that are naturally driven. We also know that salmon biomass has come down, so that will have played a role. And the oxygenation trial is proving really positive. And so while that's not necessarily responsible for the improvements that we've seen in the system, it's proving itself that it'll be quite a valuable tool moving forward. And we also know that the captive breeding program and so forth have been quite successful. So yeah, there's certainly some good signs, and the harbour's in a good condition at the moment. You know, at the same time, we know that wouldn't necessarily go as far as saying the system's recovered, because we know that harbour's quite dynamic and it can change. It's just that we're in a really good position at the moment.
And, of course, you don't have that baseline study from decades ago.
Yeah, look, I think from a water quality, from an oxygen level, we do. We rely on oxygen conditions that were measured from 1993 through to 2009, when the salmon industry wasn't really there in any degree then. So that's what we're comparing to. So when we talk about the conditions are like they were over a decade ago, we're looking at those conditions pre-salmon farming, and they're back in that range at the moment.
Are you using the oxygen machine, the bubble machine, much?
Yeah, we are using the oxygen machine. That's running at the moment continuously, and at the moment the federal government's going through a process of engaging tenders and so forth to look at transitioning that to a bigger scale.
So is it still in a trial period, or have we accepted this is the way forward?
Look, I think it's certainly ticked a lot of boxes early on, and it's certainly ticked a lot of the environmental boxes in terms of safety and performance, the oxygen staying at depth, which is what we want. We want it to stay in the environment. We're not seeing any adverse environmental effects. So I think that is the green light to start transitioning it to scale. I think it'll be important, though, over the next 2 years, when it is transitioned and we start doing it in more places, though, that environmental monitoring continues, and we continue to really have a close look at how it's operating, because you know, we don't want to operate it when we don't need to, because it uses diesel, so we want to try and make it more energy efficient. And I think that we just need to keep a close eye on the environment, because we also don't want to cause a problem either.
So transitioning to scale, what does that mean? Does it mean a different machine, or using more often, or?
Look, it probably means putting more oxygen in the water, and so the technique that we've come up with, which brings water up from depth in low oxygen, and we saturate it full of oxygen and we replace that water, is working really, really well. And so it's more about the lessons learned in terms of the maintenance of the equipment and that sort of thing, but in terms of the infrastructure that we've got to do it, we're pretty comfortable with that. And so it's more about having more of those modules, so to speak. And at the same time, though, we will look at some of the more energy efficient ways we might be able to do it, in terms of using renewables. Are there other ways that we can get the oxygen down to reduce the amount of... And that's one of the things that I think, you know, the program that the federal government have put forward over the next few years is to try and create a platform where good, smart decisions can be made in terms of when this thing operates.
So how deep does it go?
At the moment, we've got the discharge wheel down to about 30 to 40 metres. So to give you an indication, in the deep spots in the harbour's probably about 50 metres deep. There's sort of 3 deep holes, and we've sort of put it in between there. The key things that we've wanted to do is we've wanted to try and avoid disturbing the sediments on the bottom, because we know there's heavy metals in the sediments. And in the bottom of the water, at the top of the water column, Macquarie Harbour is what we call really stratified, which just means it's basically got a lot of light fresh water on the top and heavy salt water underneath, and that's really unique, and we don't want to disturb that. So we're sort of doing it somewhere between those. That's why we're choosing that depth, and that's the depth where the DO really declined. Dissolved oxygen. That's when the oxygen levels declined.
At depth,
yes. Yep.
And you just mentioned the algal on reefs here. Have you seen any technology that can help with that?
In terms of technology, I think the biggest technology is, I guess our focus has been on monitoring and how to assess how much it is, because it's really what we'd call ephemeral, or it's it can be there one season and not there the next, so it's actually quite hard to capture, and in there's some places, and so we're just trying to understand what's driving its abundance. Clearly warmer waters and high nutrient levels do. So in terms of solutions, the water's cooling down less, and less nutrients in these more sheltered locations can certainly help reduce the prevalence of nuisance algae.
Well, we've got salmon farms there, so how do they play a role? You've got climate change, salmon farms.
Yeah, look, absolutely, and I think that's one of the challenges that we've got. I think before you talked about baseline information, and I think I've talked to you before about Storm Bay, we're really well positioned because we've learned a lot of lessons about the importance of baseline information, so there's been a lot of data collected to understand what the system looked like. One of the challenges in the channel is that we've got this incredible data set of water quality and sediment health, but we don't have a very good historical record of rocky reefs and nuisance algae. We've got the observations that people are seeing, and they're absolutely to be respected. We can see them in certain shelter places. So one of the challenges, and that's where this Pennicott Foundation funding will be so critical, will be providing some really systematic understanding. So rather than just observations here and there, we'll be really able to categorise the health of the system. And then using a few different techniques in the second part of the project, we want to start looking at what the drivers are. And it is really quite challenging. I mean, we know that even when you go in the channel, if you go somewhere that's open to prevailing swells and that sort of thing, it's in much better condition than somewhere on the back of an island that's more sheltered. So there's some basic concepts like that. And they're things that are really important. I think, you know, from a salmon farming perspective, they put a lot of work into improving their feeding, so far less waste goes into the environment, and reducing the nitrogen footprint of their feed. So there's certainly an ongoing role for salmon farming and all industries in terms of contributing to an improved and healthy system.
It's a pity the baseline studies in the Don Tricasso channel didn't start a little earlier.
Oh, look, they certainly are. And when I say there certainly has been some information, but not a lot. And I think that partly, and there's been a huge amount of baseline information on other habitats. Like I said, it's not the reefs. And I think one of the reasons for that is the industry started up the top of the Huon and places like that, in really where there aren't reefs, and it was a cottage industry, and what we were really worried about were the impacts of the feces on the sediments underneath and the water quality, and the industry expanded and the monitoring expanded, but probably we've just taken a little bit of time to catch up in the reefs.
Yeah, that's Professor Jeff Ross, Senior Researcher at the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies, talking there to Fiona Breen about the research at Don Tricasso Channel and oxygen levels in Macquarie Harbour. We'll talk undersea cables very shortly, but first let's check the latest news headlines with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Tony. Tasmanian insurer the RACT says its new partnership with the University of Tasmania will help households reduce their bushfire risk. A fire at Dolphin Sands on the east coast has destroyed 19 homes and more than a dozen have been damaged in the blaze. The fire remains at watch and act level. Former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has joined One Nation after leaving the National Party in the final sitting week of Parliament. One Nation leader Pauline Hanson says Mr Joyce will continue representing his electorate of New England until the next election. She says that Mr Joyce will then stand as a candidate for One Nation on the New South Wales Senate ticket. A 25-year-old Sydney man is among three people who have been charged after a week-long blitz on the display and supply of prohibited Nazi symbols. Federal police allege the Castle Hill man performed a Nazi salute at a public gathering and imported 12 flags displaying offensive symbols. And construction's underway on a new residential parenting unit in Hobart, the 6-bed facility at St John's Park in Newtown, which is expected to open next September, will replace the 2-bed mother-baby unit at the Royal Hobart Hospital. More news at 1.
Join the ultimate party this New Year's Eve across the ABC with a massive lineup including Melanie C, plus the famous Sydney Fireworks, audio described on the ABC Listen app.
Happy New Year!
On ABC TV and iView and the ABC Listen app.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
A hidden crisis is unfolding in Australia's flagship Pacific Development Program known as the PALM Scheme, with workers leaving their Australian employers, which some say are abusive and exploitative. Some of these workers are now undocumented, unemployed and homeless, and many are now finding refuge in rural communities around the country. Lucy Cooper has the story.
I was left with nothing.
It was supposed to be an opportunity to save money for school and support her family in the Solomon Islands. But instead, Susan Pinu found herself in dire circumstances.
I feel, sad.
She came to Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM Scheme, which aims to address labour shortages in rural and regional Australia. It's often described as a win-win, filling jobs in agriculture, meat processing and aged care, while providing income for Timorese and Pacific Islanders. But the scheme has been criticised for putting its participants in danger of exploitation. For Susan, work was inconsistent. She moved to four states in just 9 months, and her take-home pay was too low because of excessive deductions.
If someone pick fast, they're going to get everything. But if you pick slow, you have nothing. Sometimes we're going to left with $100, $200.
Susan left her employer, a labour hire company, and she's not alone. More than 7,000 PALM Scheme workers have disengaged in the 5 years since 2019, a decision which puts some of them in breach of their visa conditions.
We heard all kinds of stories from people who'd left the PALM Scheme, some really harrowing accounts of, abuse and exploitation.
Dr. Kaya Barry is from Griffith University. She's among researchers from three universities who have put out a new report looking at the work and living conditions of disengaged workers.
We saw several pay slips that people showed us where they'd receive zero take-home pay, zero net pay. They're largely being exposed to situations that are equivalent to modern slavery. So they have no legal status in Australia. That means they have no support for Medicare, for work cover, for any kinds of rights that everybody else here, either on a temporary visa or an Australian citizen, has.
She said PALM Scheme workers arrive with visas tying them to one employer, and they face barriers to changing jobs if they encounter problems at work.
A lot of the workers that we've spoken to have felt that they were just unable to ask for changes, whether that's changes just to the role or the kind of work they're doing, or changes to their location in where they work.
One former PALM worker, Wayne Levy, left his employer, a labour hire company, over concerns about excessive deductions and low pay.
There is no transparency regarding our payment. We don't know what's going on. All the deduction, we don't know what we deducted for. At the end of the day, I just received, 200 and 300. So I can't support my family. I have kids back home and they have to attend their education and I have to plan, I have to meet for the future. So when I receive this sum of money, it's like a pain in my body.
He's since gained a bridging visa, which allows him to work on a citrus farm.
See, this is a good opportunity. I come and show the citrus farm. Yeah, it's a good money here.
He ended up in the New South Wales Riverina town of Leeton.
I love Leeton. I want to stay here for the whole of my life. If I can get my family here too, would be great, yeah.
The sun-drenched horticultural hub is home to fruit and rice-growing industries that fill supermarket shelves across Australia. It's here that community leaders have seen an influx of workers looking to make ends meet.
People aren't becoming disengaged here in Leeton. They're disengaged before they come to Leeton. So they come here seeking friendship, connections, and some opportunities to work.
Paul Matem leads the town's multicultural support group. He also served as the local mayor for 16 years.
We can't walk away when we see people that maybe haven't been treated fairly. They don't really know where to go. They're frightened. They don't have any real connection, so we fill that gap.
Paul Matem, ending that report from Lucy Cooper on the PALM workers. And that story is up online on ABC Rural if you'd like to know more. Well, works are set to start next year on Tasmania's most expensive infrastructure project in history. And it's not the stadium. It's Mariners Link, the Bass Strait cable that will run from Burnie on the northwest coast to Hazelwood in Victoria. So how do you build something able to withstand the elements and span hundreds of kilometres underwater and underground? Meg Ferguson met Jonathan Tan from Prismine, the company that will be responsible for building and then laying the cables.
So first of all, the subsea cable will be manufactured in our factory in Italy, and it will be actually, we call it loading the cable onto the cable laying vessel. That is actually a carousel. So it will be doing a long transit from Italy to Australia. Once it is arrived, of course, it has to be done the normal custom clearance, after which it will go to the installation site and to unspool, so-called, it's a reverse loading. You are doing it in onto the carousel, and laying, you are doing the reverse to put the cable in the water, after which the vessel will actually go along the cable route and keep paying out the cable, dropping it into the sea, and with a remote operating vehicle that monitoring the cable is properly actually touched down, and without overstressing of the cable until where the cable is installation is completed. Yeah.
So you unwind it and lay it down like I would at home, an extension cord.
Something like that, actually. Yes, in simple terms, yes. But of course, there are more engineering that we must make sure that the cable are not overstressing. We must make sure that we call it, in technical term, is catenary. There's an S-band that is not overstressing so that the cable will not be damaged during the installation. Yeah.
Now, of course, there's also the aspect of the environment, the natural environment down there. How do you ensure that you don't damage anything?
Okay, before we can perform the cable installation, we will do a pre-lay survey. So during this pre-lay survey, we will identify, of course, the obstruction and environmental, let's say the coral or whatever, those will be identified. And once they are identified, we will then design the cable routing to ensure that minimum or no disturbance along the cable route. Yes.
Quite fascinating. And then, of course, you've got to do the cable. There was 90 kilometres on land, wasn't there?
Yes, that's correct. So in order to reach out to the inland converter station, the subsea cable will take over by land cable. So the land cable will not be able to actually install like what subsea cable is doing in the single length or long extra length. So due to the transportation constraint. So what we have designed is to have a nominal length of 1.2 kilometre, which is able to be still possible to transport to the installation site and lay that length and eventually join out the each section length, which comprises of 80 sections, and form to link out to connect the subsea cable into the converter station at Hazelwood.
Now, some people have raised concerns about the cable giving off electromagnetic radiation underwater, and I can see you're laughing there. Is that a concern? Do you have to take that into account?
In fact, this is also part of our design assessment, and especially so for the magnetic field interference is actually very minimum as far as from land cable concerned, because it is actually buried below ground in at least 1 to 2 meter depth. So by the time the EMF reaching the surface is very minimum. In fact, what has to be concerned is the overhead line. Yeah. So this is why Marinos have having this consideration and having this land cable link to be underground rather than overhead. Otherwise, overhead line will be far easier to do the installation and more cost-saving than doing the underground. Yeah.
Much more expensive to bury it.
Yes. And this is actually minimise and eliminate this EMF impact to the human being. Yeah.
What about the one under the ocean?
The under the ocean is far deeper, so you have no, by the time, you know, sea is actually a conductor. So by the time this EMF will actually disperse before even reaching the sea surface, yeah.
And to the animals?
Okay, Of course, there will be actually some form of EMF impact, but that will be actually carefully looked at, and you may look at the cable design. Subsea cable and land cable, they are different. They have the armor, they have actually shield off the EMF by grounding the cable. So it will be very, very minimum, I would say negligible.
When are you expecting all of this to start construction?
For land cable, we will be actually planning to start in 2028, and subsea cable will be in 2029. Yeah.
So still a little while away.
That's correct. Now it's in the engineering phase.
Jonathan Tan, Regional Project Director for Prismine, the company that will manufacture and install giant cables between Tasmania and the mainland as part of the Marinus Link project. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk mangoes from the NT.
Hi, it's Meg Ferguson from your rural team. Why do I love the ABC Giving Tree? I know my donations stay right here in Tasmania and will make this Christmas that little bit better for someone doing it tough.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Media mogul Kerry Packer famously invested in Northern Australia's cattle industries back in the 1980s when he purchased a large portfolio of stations and kickstarted the Consolidated Pastoral Company. But in the years that followed, the media mogul also looked to pour millions of dollars into mangoes. This moment in history paved the way for an Ag Extension officer to step in and build a mango empire in the Katherine region of the Northern Territory. The NT is now Australia's largest producer of the summer fruit, and one of the pioneers of that success has been Marie Piccone.
So many, many years ago, I did agricultural science at the University of Queensland. Then I had what I call my apprenticeship, which was 6 years with the Queensland Department and 17 years being a consultant in tropical and subtropical crops. Then a very big Australian media mogul asked me to do a due diligence on some mango plantations. And
who was it?
It was Kerry Packer.
Mr. Packer.
Mr. Packer. And so an economist and I had a look at Mambaloo mangoes here in the Territory and some other properties in Queensland. And then a deposit was put down for the properties after about 18 months of due diligence. But then OneTel happened and Kerry Packer pulled back from any investments for a while because there was a significant hiccup with OneTel. At that stage, the current owner, who hadn't thought about selling until he'd been approached by the Packer Group, he then decided, okay, I am going to sell. So 5 years later, the plantations were really starting to get quite run down, and I thought, you know, they're probably cheap enough that we can buy them. And I felt quite confident that Mambaloo was an iconic brand and we could definitely bring the plantations back. So we've been doing it for 20 years and we've had 4 5-year plans so far.
Wow. And am I right in saying that if you bought Mambaloo mangoes near Katherine, your next door neighbour at Mambaloo cattle station for a moment there would have been Kerry Packer?
Correct.
Not that he lived there, but he owned with CPC.
Correct, he did. Yeah, so Mambaloo Mangoes is in the middle of Mambaloo Cattle Station.
Yeah.
We're freehold 550 hectares in the middle of the station, which is 400,000 hectares, a million acres. And yeah, Kerry owned it for sort of several years while we were just getting started at Mambaloo.
So what was it like trying to turn a mango orchard in a very remote area that was a bit run down into a commercial success?
Well, I think that some of the really key components were that I needed to build a team and have a very clear vision and some really clear activities about what were the priorities. And the priorities were to bring the yield and the quality back, to get more water and to get a supply chain in place that meant that the mangoes could be delivered in the very best quality possible. So one of the really interesting things, which was a challenge, was that there was a lot of practice in the Territory where things were just done a particular way. And I can remember once asking a truckie in the early days, I said, could you please turn the cooler on in the truck before we load it? And it was typical of what happened in those days to me. He just said, you want what, lady? So I would suggest that it wasn't easy, but there were also some amazing opportunities and amazing people that really supported us. And now nobody asks us about turning the cooler on.
And in general, what do you think have been some of the great achievements of the Northern Territory's mango industry, not just Mambaloo?
Sure. Overall, the Northern Territory mango industry is delivering mangoes in August, September, October, November, and for some of December. And they've increased the volume available to Australians and people around the world, actually doubled the volume that we used to have when it was only when production was only coming from Queensland. So it's been an expansion of the industry thanks to the Northern Territory developing a mango industry. I still come across people who can't believe that mangoes come from the Northern Territory. And I say, well, actually, over 50% of the mangoes that are consumed and produced in Australia do come from the Northern Territory.
Murray Piccone from Mambaloo Mangoes speaking to Matt Brand, and there are plenty of mangoes on the shelves this year at pretty good prices at the moment. Well, the Country Hour has been celebrating its 80th anniversary with some special programs all throughout last week. Due to popular demand, here's a little snapshot of some of those programs from all over Australia, highlighting the affection that people have for the show and how reporters feel about working.
80 years for the ABC's Country Hour. That's a big milestone, isn't it?
Yes, I remember the day it started. I would have been about 13, and my dad was really excited because he was a very keen wool grower. I swept the boards for him and was the tar boy and everything. He thought that this was going to be a good thing because, you know, we'd be filled in with what the wool was making and everything.
You'd get in trouble for talking at church on a Sunday, but you'd get in more trouble if you were talking during the weather, during the Country Hour, any day of the week. That was always a good childhood memory of ours. And we've learned very quickly that this is an incredibly important part of the day, around that 12:30 every day, and you don't talk when the weather is on.
I've been listening to the Country Hour for all my life. It's still the most important source of agricultural information, especially the market reports. I grew up listening to the Country Hour with my dad, and now I listen to it in my air-conditioned tractor while I'm ploughing the paddocks.
I think working in agriculture and trying to stay at the forefront of production and profitability, you should always be looking for the next thing, and you should always be looking for what you might need to change. It's programs like, you know, the Country Hour that allow those issues to be aired.
When you think about, you know, a person at 80, the grand man, the historic holder, and I think that's important for the ABC to continue to stay at its roots, to stay at its base, and support and honour that, but to also be that voice of wisdom.
Warwick, you know, I really congratulate you and your team. It's just a magnificent organisation. I just hope that there's another 80 years.
Well, we'll take another 100. Don't worry about that, Kevin. That's great. Would love to finish before we go to markets with the Bozza and Wozza show. You text in a lot about your sheepdog trials and so forth, and regular texter and caller to the Country Hour too. What does it mean to you, mate?
Oh, mate, the Country Hour means everything. All these people here have just touched on the surface of it. With the information that comes out every day with the market reports, your accurate weather forecasts, the way things are going on. Yeah, going on. Why not? Why not?
But it's been great. It's been company to you then?
Oh, mate, every day.
What a great show it's been. 80 years, it's pretty big. And you'd think ABC management would have done something to the show over 80 years, but it's still good and it's still the same. It's still on at the same time. So no, that's a big plus.
No Botox, no nothing.
Nothing, yeah. Nothing, same thing.
Farmers know better than anyone just what the weather can throw at them. I've spoken to farmers and producers who are going through some of the toughest times they'll face. Floods, storms, fires, whatever nature has decided to throw at them, and they're still so determined not to walk away it makes me incredibly proud to be a rural reporter.
We just cared so much about what we were doing. We cared so much about being part of the rural department. We cared so much about the farmers that were listening to us and supporting them through those ups and downs, the droughts, the floods, all of those things. And, you know, it's wonderful we're still doing that now. We are special within the ABC, and we're seen that way by the listeners. And we do, they do feel like they know us, and they really do connect with us in a very special way. And, you know, and that's part of the reason that when my husband, you know, proposed to me live on the radio, I got such a reaction, because everyone felt like they knew me.
Yeah.
And that's, and we've got that connection too, so when we ask people to ring up about rainfall or, you know, whatever, they all ring in because they know us and they feel like they know us.
You meet some of the most interesting people in Australia, in rural Australia. I mean, farmers, for a starter, some of the most innovative farmers in the world, doing all sorts of really interesting and innovative things. So you get to go out and have a chat to them and sit around the kitchen table. That was a real privilege, I think. Yeah, I love that.
Nowhere else on the planet, not even the BBC, have done the sort of job that the ABC has done in this regard. And the strength of it was always reporters reporting from one side of the country to the other and everywhere in between on the issues that mattered to people where they lived, and particularly those people on the land who are the land managers for most of the landscape that we call Australia, but also some of the big export earners for our country as well. Yep. With the things that they produce.
Yeah.
It might be that the ABC is the last media outfit standing across most of Australia within our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. So isn't that a sobering thing to contemplate?
Yeah. I was trying to think when I first started listening to the Country Hour, so I have to blame my grandfather, and I was pretty crook when I was a kid, so I lived a long time, a couple of years with my grandparents, and he had this system of coming in of a lunchtime, have lunch, lay down, and shush, listen to Country Hour. So I learnt to listen to Country Hour. I'd already heard it, but not listened to it. And then on top of that, we had Blue Hills afterwards.
It's interesting reflecting on the 80 years of the Country Hour and what you've been going through. My first recollections of the Country Hour was certainly as a young man at not even probably grade 7 or grade 6 and sitting around the lunch table at Nan and Pop's. Always used to go to Nan and Pop's because the lunch was brilliant. As a
yes, and so always is.
Pop would always come in and he'd turn the radio straight on and you'd listen to the Country Hour for an hour, and then once he'd had his lunch, he'd go back out and he'd say, come on, young fella, off we go again.
Yeah.
And that was always my earliest memories of the Country Hour. They sat down religiously, and this would have been, you know, late 70s, maybe early 80s, and sat down and listened diligently to the radio for that 1 hour.
Yeah, Terry Grow and Nick Hansen ending that report, compiled by David Claughton and featuring thoughts from around the country about people's memories of the Country Hour celebrating that 80 years of broadcasting. The show put a podcast of today's program up for you. Don't forget ABC Rural Online and also our ABC Rural Facebook page. We will catch you with another Country Hour after midday tomorrow.